Can you hear me? Welcome to this town hall. It is a great pleasure to be back at McDonald, and I'm here accompanied by the Deputy Provost, Morton Mendelson. I'm Heather Monroe Bloom, Principal and Vice Chancellor of McGill and a professor in the Faculty of Medicine. Typically, when I come out to McDonald, we have an open forum on just about any issue or conversation that topic that you'd like to speak to. Today I do have a special theme that I wanted to speak to, and I am going to refer to some of my notes because I want to talk to you about the development of the work of the Task Force on Diversity, Excellence, and Community Engagement, and to get your feedback on that. We have roughly an hour and a half to meet, or up to it, for as long as you want to meet. And so if we move through the Task Force discussion, I'd be very happy to move to other topics that may be top of mind for you. I do want to welcome as well the members of the task force who are here with us today. We have several, and thank you for coming. And this is the first program-based consultation we've done on the task force. And so hearing from you, hearing your feedback on the recommendations and what these mean to you is very, very important. And because you constitute not only an important campus and set of programs of McGill, but your own community, you'll have your own take on what these recommendations mean. And in that regard, we want to hear from you. And so again, thanks to the members of the task force who are here. Now, the Deputy Provost is going to serve as moderator, and I don't know, Professor Mendelson, whether you'd wanted to say a few words or if... No, or not.
Okay, I'll just go through the format that we're going to use. The principal is going to make a few remarks about the task force recommendations, and then we're going to open up the conversation, as she's already mentioned. We're interested in hearing from as many people as possible, students, academic, administrators, and support staff, because we want to know what the recommendations mean to you, what your responses are to them. This is very much in the spirit of getting as broad input as possible on the issues that we obviously think are very important. My job is to help keep things moving along. There aren't a lot of people here, so I don't think that's going to be very very difficult here. We're going to ask people who want to talk to come to one of the microphones. The point of that is, even though we can probably hear you here, we're streaming this event, and we need you at the microphone so that people who might be listening online can, in fact, hear what the questions are. I would like you to, when we get to that point, I'd like you to please identify yourself by name and mention the department in which you work or study, so that we just have an idea of the breadth of people who are here. So we'll now ask the principal to say a few words about the task force recommendations.
Thank you very much. Could I ask how many of you have actually read the task force's report? About a third of you. So I'll take 5-7 minutes just to run through the backdrop and goals of it, to touch lightly on the recommendations, and then I really want to turn it over to you. You'll know that in 2005, I launched a principal task force on student life and learning, feeling that students are a main event at the university. It had been a long time since we'd had an institution-wide look at what the issues were that made us a good place to come and study, live and learn as a student, and what the challenges were. And we've gone through a process, a very broad consultation on that, a task force report that came back to Senate and Board for information and discussion, and then for an administrative response to the Provost. And the administrative response to that task force has formed the basis for an annual report card, actually the basis for the creation of a an office of Deputy Provost Student Life and Learning, and then for an annual report back, and many measures being worked on in the interim to realize the recommendations of that report. One that came up at a terrific lunch we just had hosted with the dean and with the president of the Graduate Student Society here, and with a couple of our professorial colleagues here, was on the whole issue of student life out at the McDonald's campus, and we may want to move into that afterwards, but that's one example of the areas that have come forward. This whole theme of diversity, excellence, and community engagement is another theme that seemed to strike at the heart of what we are as a university. We have a research-intensive, publicly purposed mission and mandate. We aim to serve the local communities, certainly here out in the West Island, downtown in Quebec, but also to serve at the national and international levels. We think of ourselves as diverse intellectually and diverse because of the tremendous international quality of our professoriate and our student body, and the multiculturalism, multilingualism of the broad McGill community. But nonetheless, there are certain questions we hadn't asked ourselves, at least not in a long time, and there were areas of concern that were coming to the fore on a fairly regular basis about how inclusive we were. And this ranged on everything from how inclusive we are from ideas expressed differently to different modes of studying and learning, doing research and doing scholarship, to acceptance of people who come from different backgrounds. And so let me just say that the task force was put together as an administrative task force to advise me, do research on my behalf, and then to work in a broad framework of consultations with the community. We invited we sent out a broad invitation for written submissions, and then had a whole array of groups and individuals come in and present to us. But the goal is for the task force to have its work culminate in a set of very concrete recommendations and strategies for making improvements in the areas of diversity, excellence, and community engagement, and the interaction of these three basic domains, clearly, truly a community-wide initiative for McGill. I drew across the two campuses for the membership of the task force, faculty, administrative and support staff, board members, alumni, and students. We began our work in the fall of 2009, and working groups were created to consider and develop reports and recommendations relevant to the task force mandate. The task force received over 60 briefs from members of the campus community and some from the broader Montreal community as well, and panels were convened at which 24 authors of submissions at our invitation came to explain their recommendations or their observations. And we also looked and had quite an extensive effort to look at what peer universities in Canada and the U.S. in particular, but not only, were doing in these areas. And one of the things that we began with was an inventory of what the activities were that were already taking place across the university on both of our campuses. And I must say we were overwhelmed in a positive way with the extraordinary array of community outreach initiatives conducted by all members of the university of community, the university community, all constituencies. You'll have seen one example perhaps highlighted recently by our dental faculty, which has long held a mobile dental clinic in downtown Montreal for people who are homeless or in need. We've just opened up a permanent dental clinic run by our students and faculty at the Wellcome Mission downtown. This was one example, but again, many, many with different groups, with our Native communities in the local area, but also the far north, in working with for example, our professional programs working with their allied organizations out in the community. And what we learned from surveying of the university was that we don't know what we're doing, and that a lot of good things are happening, but we don't benefit from the opportunity to generalize from that learning, to share examples and experiences of what works and what doesn't, and frankly, to connect the networks of communities with which we work. So the aims of the task force were to have a set of recommendations that will grow excellence consistent with our mission, and you can say, well, what does that mean? And we'll talk about it. Enhancing and better recognizing individual and institutional performance, making our community more welcoming and supportive, and being out in the community in more visible ways. That is strengthening our relationships with and contributing to the broader communities of Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and beyond, as well as increasing the impact of those relationships. Let me say how proud I am of the work done by the many members of the task force, the students who worked with us in supporting the work of the task force, and all who consulted with us made submissions that were extremely thoughtful, hard work all round. So the report, and again, I'll touch on it briefly. You've got it. It's online. There's now, I'm looking at Wendy Owens, who's been a senior colleague working on this, is our summary of it up online now as well. So a brief executive summary of the report and the major recommendations is also now online. But just to tell you what's in it, the report includes a statement that describes diversity and excellence in a linked fashion, not as contradictory objectives, but as not as contradictory, but as complementary objectives. We have three bundles of recommendations, if you will, each one with a series of measures that are recommended as having a positive contribution to academic and non-academic life at McGill. And so these recommendations are, one, that McGill University will demonstrate a firm commitment to the recruitment, retention, and excellence of academic staff, administrative and support staff, and students, placing a strong emphasis on expanding the candidate pools and the pipelines of future candidates to accelerate progress in enhancing the diversity of these pools of people who make up the McGill community. It's noted, and we heard this several times, including from those at other universities who've worked to implement a strategy touching on these three themes in an integrated way, that there are sort of concerns or fears that are commonly held in research universities when you embark on a new initiative focused on enhancing diversity, excellence, and community engagement. And this has to do with the quality of faculty who will be recruited, the quality of students who will be recruited, and the shaping of curricula. And these are often viewed to be at risk when you move into talking about expanding diversity, looking at issues of access, and thinking about whether or not the way we go about our business normally in recruiting students and faculty in particular should have a second look. And at McGill, we're extraordinarily proud of the quality of our students and our professors. In fact, we've had some local feedback recently that our student body may be the strongest in the world, that we don't have a legacy program. You can't inherit or buy your way into McGill. You come in on the basis of your academic and intellectual abilities and your record to date, and that we're quite unique in that regard, having very, very high standards of academic qualification for entry, and then no way of mediating around that. And clearly, when you move into thinking about questions of diversity, it's not unusual to say, well, are we doing that in a way that allows us to draw on highly qualified people, but who come from atypical backgrounds or who don't think of McGill as a place that has room for them at the student or professorial level? And what we found is that all the universities that had gone through an initiative like this had those concerns up front, and that they were unfounded. That is, that there was not reason to believe that moving in this direction weakens the academic standards of the university in any way, and quite the opposite can be the outcome. And I want to say as well, and I won't take a long time to talk about it, we can talk about this in the exchange, that we did not embrace an affirmative action kind of model as the way of building diversity, excellence, and community engagement in an integrated way. The emphasis was much more on expanding the pipeline of qualified applicants from a diverse range of backgrounds into our programs and to thinking about diversity of the intellectual work, the academic work, the research and scholarship that happens at McGill in ways that would strengthen our reputation academically. So that was interesting. There was, so let me just say that the definition in the report, there's a definition that includes intellectual diversity because a diverse range of opinions is extremely important to the value of the university. And we believe, in fact, that diversity of a range of descriptions would strengthen the university overall. There was absolute agreement that making the campuses more physically accessible is a very high priority. I know this has been an issue at prior town halls that we've had out here at the McDonald campus. You can imagine with our downtown campus built on a mountain with many heritage and historical buildings that physical access for people who have any mobility problems is a challenge. And so some of our recommendations are quite precise in thinking about how we systematically get at making it a better place for people who have mobility and other physical challenges. Our definition, this is recommendation two, our definition of excellence at McGill shall be broadened to ensure that the indicators of excellence that we value and with which we measure ourselves correspond with our mission, including our broad commitment to societal impact. That's a new dimension in thinking about the formal mission of McGill, that it's not just what we do and the quality of what we do on our campuses within our university, but the ability of that to make a contribution to society in positive ways that's also, we recommend, be formalized in our mission statement. And so you'll see in looking at the report that many of the measures that are proposed relate to exploring new and innovative ways of teaching, new and innovative forms of pedagogy, a broader array of learning outcomes, and a stronger emphasis on interdisciplinarity, but not for the sake of interdisciplinarity, really in ways that, again, strengthen the quality and impact of our academic work. Recommendation three is to affirm a commitment to McGill's positive engagement with and impact on outside communities locally, nationally, and globally, to build innovatively and progressively on the university's history of service to society, and thereby to expand opportunities for research, scholarship, and learning. The task force is also recommending that we develop sustained and multi-stranded relationships with communities outside of the university, and particularly with those where the members of those communities are underrepresented at McGill. And one area that I'll just touch on is we were, and this will interact with a survey recently led out of the Office of the Deputy Provost to look at what is the diversity of our student population currently. We were pleased to see that, in fact, we do have 25% of our students who are the first in their families to go to the university, to go to any university. That's not a bad surrogate for looking at people who come from a less resourced socioeconomic background. But that differs quite dramatically, nonetheless, from the student populations of public universities in general, where roughly half of the students come from families where they are the first in their family to go to university. And so that's something that we are very conscious of, and one of the considerations for us then was how do we reach out into communities of talented students who are the first in their families to go to university or to be thinking of going to university, to connect them with McGill in ways that may make them both think of applying to coming to us and then have a successful career with us as students. Let me just then finish on what the consultation process has been and will be. The report has now been reviewed by the deans and senior team, the chairs and directors of our academic programs by Senate. It will be presented to our Board of Governors this month. At each meeting so far, we've had an open and productive exchange, which has allowed us to improve the recommendations and clarify the report. And here we really want your feedback, which we'll come to in a few moments. As I said, there will be a request for an administrative response from the provost and the vice principal finance and administration, who will write a formal response to the report stating what the administration is committed to doing in relation to those recommendations, and then detailed steps for how they'll respond. And because I'm about to cough, I'm going to stop there and open it up. Thank you very much. Go ahead. So, over to you.
Okay. As I said, right now we'd like to hear your comments, questions, concerns,
and ideas.
The report now, as you have heard, is very much in the direction of goals, recommendations to achieve goals. We have not dealt with the issues of how those recommendations will be implemented. That will come with the administrative response. So if we could have the conversation dealing with the goals as set out in the recommendations, that would be helpful. So I invite comments. And I'm going to wait 29 seconds.
Don't be shy, please.
Which is the could you please come to? Sorry, and please identify yourself for the people.
We just had lunch. John Dalton, Institute of Parasitology. Interesting document, but I with regards to the teaching, I do see. One of the recommendations that we should change the way we teach. And I have to agree with you, because downtown I gave a lecture to supposedly 80 students, but only about 12 turned up. Mm-hmm. Clearly, that's not the way we want to teach. We need to, we put our lectures onto the web, or whatever, and the students are happy to download. But we need to get them into the classroom, and we need to teach in a different way, such that they can't just download our lectures. They need to learn and be in contact. So I'm glad to see this. That's my comment here.
John, would you give us some of your thoughts about how to do that?
Yeah, I will. I'll write some thoughts.
Okay. We hear a lot about the, both from professors and from students, from academic staff and from students, that there's a great desire to innovate in the way we teach, and we take it seriously. And indeed, there's a I believe that in the someone cough into the microphone, that'd be great. In the current planning process, the provost and the deans are talking about what each faculty is going to do by way of innovating in this area. But I think having suggestions from the community is really important about what that means to you and what you'd like to see for you as a professor, for our students from the student point of view. So I urge all of you to think about that and give us input. But John, having led on it, we'll look to you.
Yeah. My other question is, how will McGill see the future of integrating with other universities in Montreal? Like Concordia is right down the road, University of Montreal close by. Yeah. They're not mentioned here. I guess they're the local community. Is that what?
Yeah, we do view them to be part of the local community. It's a great question, though, and indeed we have an extraordinary number of collaborations, academic collaborations, some service collaborations, some content, continuing education collaborations with Montreal-based institutions. We have a very exciting new initiative with the École Technologie Supérieure to develop a quartier innovation in the downtown area. We've actually started for the first time to have a series of breakfast meetings, the senior teams of the universities, to look at what we can be doing together. But I think you should see that as open territory in this, in the framework of the task force. And if there are recommendations and suggestions, one of the things I think we want to do is not just do them at the local level, but see how can we really leverage these up. So, for example, if you think of the environmental sciences theme, every university in Montreal has something going on there, but we've not really created a way of maximizing or leveraging the expertise, which is quite complementary. I think each university is doing something a little different where we could bring these together, so it's a great suggestion.
I think it's an opportunity that the universities interact and don't duplicate.
Yeah.
And that's what it's just an observation of mine that there is a bit of competition between the universities, and that's not good for Montreal or Quebec. Mm-hmm. And there could be more overlapping courses, and you know.
Yeah. So we welcome initiatives in that regard. We cannot control what the newspapers say or do with what we do. Uh-huh. So, for example, Montreal is the only city in Canada with two faculties of medicine. That is viewed to be a huge asset. In other cities in North America, here it has often been used as sort of a political point in the newspapers, notwithstanding there's tremendous collaboration between our faculties of medicine, more than in some universities within their own faculties of medicine. So we want to focus on the substance and what we do, build those networks and the impacts of them. But as I say, we can't control necessarily what the newspapers say about it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We really want to hear from you, so there's no comment or question that's unwelcome on this. And the more ideas and suggestions, the better.
Good afternoon. My name is Connor Cleary. I'm in the Farm Management and Technology program, third year. In terms of getting students in the classrooms, many of the lectures are available for download, but that doesn't really get the participation that's necessary to learn properly or desired by both the students and the lecturers. What there needs to be is an interaction between the students and the professors during the whole 90-minute lecture or however long it goes. They should be able to download the lecture. However, they should be present and communicating with the students and the professor the whole time during that time period. It's not enough just to view it later. They should be interacting the whole time.
And do you have suggestions about how we... What it is that might be done that discourages that, or what we might do to encourage more of that interaction?
Well, I think there should be public programs available on Macs and PCs that the students can use. One program that works for everyone that they won't have technical difficulties and they can't use. My microphone doesn't work, or I don't have a webcam, or things like that. Something like WebCT, where they can interact and it's reliable, and during the whole lecture they can be present and communicating the whole time. Is that kind of
good? Thank you very much. That's helpful. I wonder if any of the task force members who are here wanted to make any comments, or I don't feel put on the spot, but if you. It is an opportunity. Do you want to come up to me?
I just had a question. What kind of class sizes are you talking about here?
But at least you're present in to the conversation.
I do know of a certain, it just depends on who's teaching and how.
Professorship.
Okay, face this way. I do know that there are several programs that are being taught in this integrated way. Sometimes I think with the larger classes, there's no option but to maybe reduce the number of students if you want the interaction. But since it's online, I mean, I think WebCity has its limitations, and so I agree that we do need to look at certain programming, but I think the class size is obviously a real issue, and I know that McGill right now is looking at a strategy on the digital economy, and we're looking at, you know, different ways of teaching and learning, so maybe something will come out of that.
Thank you. This is Professor Sharif from the Faculty of Education, a member of the task force. Other questions or comments on this? Yes, please.
Microphone, it's not very diverse. There we go. My name is Matthew Brown. I'm a graduate student in the School of Dietetics and Human Nutrition here at MAC. And I've taken part in keeping on this teaching excellence point. I've taken part in two different teaching workshops available to graduate students, one here at MAC, which is much smaller than the one I took part in downtown. It was hosted by David Sincox and his skill sets team. Absolutely amazing. It was all graduate students. It's not the graduate students that are primarily teaching the students at McGill. So I think having professors take part in these workshops, because there were some great ideas that in all the classes I've done in the past 6 years in my university career, I never see these techniques used. Very, very rarely I see these techniques used. So yeah, I guess I'm not sure.
What would be some examples, Matt?
This was last year I took these. Just different things you could do with your presentation slides, different ways of interacting with students in the classroom. And I think that is the major one, to get students coming to class as opposed to just downloading the lecture, the video of the lecture online.
Your suggestion is to open these up more broadly than to graduate students?
Exactly. I'm not sure of if these similar workshops are available to professors currently, but I know that it was a very big workshop that took part in many different rooms that dealt with many different things associated with teaching assistants. But again, it's the professors that are teaching the students,
yeah.
So it should be them that are incorporating these things into the lectures, and I think that would be, again, I'm not sure if it's already available to
professors. We have a big program on teaching to facilitate teaching and learning.
Okay.
But it's an interesting thought to what extent what we do in that program and what happens in the graduate student teaching experience have integrated principles and some sharing across the two groups, so it's a great suggestion.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just ask, yes, please.
Good afternoon. Chris Bottle, Department of Natural Resource Sciences. Just a quick comment on teaching. I think in general we've embraced technology to such a degree that we've become to rely on it far too much. And as a general comment, I think we need to step back a little bit and rethink how we approach technology as a tool rather than a crutch in our teaching. I teach an entire class with a piece of chalk and don't put anything on WebCT, and the students, the attendance rate is really quite high, and it's a very interactive class because the lights have to be up so that people can see the blackboard. So there's different very simple things we can do where we just see technology in a different way. I use WebCT, but not for lecture notes and not for slides. Students may have a slightly different opinion of the class than me, but
they're there.
They're there, and it's an interactive class, and I think we can do that with a lot more classes, and we just see PowerPoint as an easy way to put up slides. So. That wasn't what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to ask about interdisciplinary courses and the approach of interdisciplinary. We struggle with historical silos, and interdisciplinary is about breaking those down. Yet we still need those structures, but we also need to break them down. And I think sometimes the structures play too big a role when trying to really think about interdisciplinary, and other than things like the MSc, which is a great example of trying to break down those structures. So I guess it's just a comment that we have to deal face on with whether there are ways to rethink the way the university is structured. If we want to take interdisciplinary on seriously, we need to think about that. And I don't have a simple solution other to say we have that. That's a big problem in terms of embracing interdisciplinary. Just more of a comment than a question.
Yeah, well, it's a great comment. And one of the things that we found is even where we offer programs that are interdisciplinary, it's not always easy for students to access them. That's one. And for professors who want to do interdisciplinary work, particularly in a pre-tenure phase, there's anxiety about kind of stepping away from your home department to do some of these things that may feel somewhat more experimental. And there are a lot of good examples out there about how to do interdisciplinarity in ways that reinforce academic quality and strength, don't abandon some of the core disciplines upon which the interdisciplinarity is based, and still allow for more open participation. And so those are some of the things that I'll be looking at the provost to respond on in the administrative response. But certainly there shouldn't be penalties for it.
There shouldn't be penalties, and there's so many in opportunities for enrichment in terms of your professional life and you know, moving ahead in your career. But it's we're still sort of halfway there. We're sort of stuck in our units and our departments. But we also are encouraged to broaden our perspectives, and it's a real struggle, I think, at an individual level, but even at a bigger level than that.
No, there is a real call for innovation. Remember, we're building on hundreds of years of history of the university being founded on departments that are discipline focused, and so how do we not throw the baby out with the bathwater, but because core disciplines have an important place as well, but create these new opportunities. And one of the things I think about from the institutional perspective is how do we make sure we're not getting in the way of creative things happening that should be happening. For example, 20 years ago, it would have been very hard to anticipate the interface of engineering and biology. Today, it's hard to think about either one alone. Have our structures kept up with that kind of a trend? So your comments are much appreciated and I think spot on. We need to feel, I think we shouldn't have to think about restructuring the entire university in order to make progress. So what are the steps we can take that will open the place up in that regard? I must say, coming from another university to McGill 8 years ago, I was struck at the vast expanse of interdisciplinary work that has happened from the ground up, and I think it has. The McGill School for the Environment is a great example of that, but there are many, you know, take the whole neurosciences area, some 6 or 7 faculties involved in neurosciences, including music. Who would have thought of that? And I think in some of those cases, it's been a matter of us getting out of the way, letting people do what they do naturally. But even our granting councils have not gone the full distance in understanding how to adjudicate interdisciplinary research proposals. So we need to do our part within the university, but I think we need to give some leadership as well to some of the other spheres of influence that we have to make sure that we're not fixing one piece of the whole cycle of innovation and the way disciplines work together and setting people up for failure and not being able to get their grants funded, for example. And I think Canada and Quebec have made big strides in that direction, but there's still a big ways to go as well. Thank you.
David Lewis, Associate Dean, Student Affairs here on the McDonald campus. Madam Principal, I've attended most of your town halls over the years, and I usually just sit back and behave myself. Not that I'm standing to misbehave today, please don't get me wrong, but I served on your first task force on student life and learning, and I know the effort that goes into that. And I must admit I was pleased not to be asked to serve on this one for that very reason. But it's interesting, as I look at the document and certainly this snapshot of the summary and the recommendations, I guess I can relate to a lot of this because a lot of this actually surfaced in that first round of conversations. And clearly one can't address all of these overnight, but a number of these that pertain to students, I want to just make a comment or two on. In the first bank of recommendations, with respect to number 6, 7, and 8, for example, number 6, support efforts to recruit and retain a more diverse qualified student body, including Francophones. Well, of course, we have a really good Francophone component on this campus. We always have, and we will continue to work on that. One of the things that is a work in progress for us, though, is you refer here to promote student adjustment to McGill with transitional year programs. Mm-hmm. And certainly our dean, with the help of the Office of the Provost and the Deputy Provost, have been struggling to make that freshman year a much more important, enjoyable, productive year for those students. So we've come a long way in the last year or two. We still have a way to go, but at least it's a work in progress. Yeah. And we're feeling really quite good about that, and it's nice that you identify that in here. Number 7, facilitate access to degree programs for outstanding students who have followed non-traditional pathways. I'm delighted to see this front and center. I know that most student affairs offices have struggled with some of these students in the past, and to have it highlighted now, I think, gives it a recognition that it really deserves. And then number 8, which has to do with physical accessibility. That's going to continue to be an issue, we know that, but again, for the folks that are disabled, at least it is front and center, and we will continue to chip away at it. In the second bank, the three that I just wanted to comment very briefly on, numbers 1, 3, and 4, extend learning beyond the traditional classroom experience. Number 3, encourage and support the development of interdisciplinary courses that are co-designed and so on. And we see a lot of that with our environment courses, especially within the McGill School of Environment. And then encourage curriculum committees to provide opportunities for students to be exposed to areas and topics outside of the primary discipline. As you and the provost and the deputy provost are aware, we have a growing population. These are some of the challenges that we are facing now. How do we continue to teach with the limited resources that we have, and perhaps we will be able to contribute in some way, novel ways of getting the message across. I support Professor Buttle's comments. I know that Professor Buttle is a wonderful instructor, and we sometimes get caught up in this electronic media. And I remember a number of years ago when I was recognized for my teaching that was a time when I really hadn't joined the electronic forum. Now I have, and I agree with Professor Buttle. Students have too, and they're not in the classroom with you as much as they used to be. And so we do need to recognize that and think about how we're going to continue to teach and get our message across. But number 4, encourage curriculum committees to provide opportunities. I hope that will transcend campuses, because that is an issue that we've had on this campus for a long, long time. We have programs that we are proud of, that we feel are quite solid in their design, but we are, of course, shortchanged in many respects because we don't have the breadth of courses offered on that other campus. And although we have a shuttle going back and forth, that's not designed for timetabling. Mm-hmm. And if we could find ways of having some of our colleagues from other faculties, whether it be education, arts, and so on, find ways of teaching on this campus to again enliven the students who are following programs here, I think that would be quite helpful as well. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you. Very very helpful comments. One of the comments that Professor Lewis made that I'll build on is that the emphasis on the first year experience has, as you've said, gone very well. Not uniformly, but I think enormous progress. It's one of the areas where we've really had our community band together, from our academic staff and our students, indeed to our alumni, in giving support for special initiatives, including our Governor Emeritus, Senator Meehan, and his wife Kelly, who've given us very strong support to the first year experience. We're actually thinking of taking it back into the pre-university admissions period, so that we would have a pre-freshman year, transitional year program that might be, and that this would still need to be defined and frankly endorsed and embraced by the provost. But some universities have very successfully reached out into their communities or into communities that are viewed to be at high risk for having young people not go to university to take some very promising students who haven't been performing academically in a way that would get them admitted, for example, to McGill, and to work with them in a year in a very special program, a typically very small focused group program, and ready them for university. Some of those hopefully would come to McGill, but others may go to university elsewhere, but it would be making a contribution in any event. And I know Dean Madramutu and I were talking on the way over about the outreach into the Aboriginal community. And we debated quite a bit at the task force whether we actually identify specific groups that we want to reach out to, and decided that we did want to do that, and that underrepresented visible minorities were one group, Aboriginals were another group, and those from lower socioeconomic, financially resourced backgrounds was another group. So as we think about that, McDonald's actually succeeded in having a very strong representation of Francophone students. And on the downtown campus, we feel we've done well at that, but there's actually a strong desire on the part of all members of our community to have more French language capacity available, the development of French language capacity available as in all parts of the university life. And the government of Quebec has put an emphasis on, for example, with international students going to the Francophone universities, giving them a lot of access to French language instruction. We think it'd be very important for McGill and the other formerly Anglophone universities to have the same opportunities. Other comments, questions on the task force?
I have a question in regards to the community outreach, just to follow up on what you're saying.
Just identify yourself.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Matav Nazemi. I'm a grad student and course lecturer in the Faculty of Education at the downtown campus. Of course, I guess we don't have education here, right? Sorry. So I just wondered how much of the community outreach is more about, for one thing, self-determination as far as the communities that would like to collaborate with McGill and how they see that collaboration done, and also how much of it is about reinventing the wheel and how much of it is about tagging on to initiatives that already are in place. For example, QPIRG, so for those that don't know, stands for Quebec Public Interest Research Group, at McGill has a really neat program they call CURE, which stands for Community University Research Exchange. And there are already professors at McGill that allow for students to do work within the community, like research work identified by the community, and get credit for that, either for a course or for a research project. So that's, I think, a really great initiative, and it's something that can be added on to or adopted by the university or even just supported by the university.
In fact, I believe it's in our inventory of the programs that are occurring already that might be used as examples for others to employ. But it is it's a fine example, and it speaks as well to different models of doing research and doing community based research and how you form partnerships in that context. And you know, one of the values behind the recommendations of the report is that, you know, our mission and our aim is not to go do things to communities. It is really, as with the Wellcome Mission collaboration on the dental clinic, to do these things hand in glove and mutually identify the opportunities. We had one, just as one example, principal of a school come and present and offer to partner with us. For example, if we did something like the transitional year program, reaching out and forming a special program to make it more likely that some students would come to university who wouldn't otherwise, you know, he offered himself and his school up as a partner, and I think that's the kind of partnership that we want to make, and there are many community and social service agencies that are similar in that regard. So thank you, but it's great to highlight that. Yes.
Good afternoon. Nicolas Châtelonnet from Natural Resources Science. I would like to come back on the comment by Christopher Bottle concerning interdisciplinarity. Just to point out one neat experiment that was started by the former Minister of Education, Michel Courchen, about 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. It was in CGEF, she created the concept of transdisciplinary courses that were started at my former CGEF for the first time this year. I was on the committee that tried to create those classes. There are complementary classes that have, by definition, to be created by more than one department. These classes have for subject one particular problematic. It could be, for instance, the problems of touristic islands in the Caribbean. They're really based on one subject, and professors of more than one discipline will teach together a class to show students very concretely how many approaches can be important in understanding the problem. On that example, it would give, for example, let's say a professor of economics that would teach about the impact of the World Bank politics on how these islands have to do a certain type of economy, and the professor of biology that would explain how the switch from agriculture to tourism would have an impact on, let's say, groundwater or something like that.
And so it's a problem-based learning model.
Exactly, yeah. But with more than one discipline. And that can really, as if it were one course in all programs, it would really build in students the understanding that putting more than one department together can bring on a higher comprehension of everything, basically.
Yeah.
So though it's a CGEP initiative, it could be interesting to try to apply it in university.
Yeah, very good example. Thank you. And I think, Dean Madramutu, you've developed a number of these programs, and I think it was the inception of the McGill School for the Environment came out of wanting to do that. It's great to have the examples, because for those of you who are thinking about how to move in those directions, it makes it more accessible to do so. We've got about a half an hour left. I'm wondering if this is a good moment to turn to just some other general issues that you may want to discuss. But if we move off the task force, I'd just like you to invite you, if you're reading the report for the first time and you have comments, suggestions, ideas, concerns, to encourage you to please send those in to us. There is a website for the task force, and there's an easy way of making submissions on it. And then just over to you, back to you, on any other issues you might want to raise. Please.
My name is Mike Blue. I'm from Facility Management. I spent most of my last 25 years on campus, living and working on campus, and I've noticed that the buildings, whether it's Britton Hall, Glenelville House, structures like the water tower, which is slated to be torn down within a month and a half, personally I'd like this structure left. It's got our logo. Just to take it down is going to cost you thousands and thousands of dollars. All it needs basically is a paint job. What's happening at Britton Hall? It's been vacant for the last 25 to 30 years. Glenella Del House, all these buildings are beautiful structures, but nothing's being done to keep them
Yeah, this is, thank you for expressing your concern, and you're not alone in it. In fact, we spoke at lunchtime about all three of these, particularly Britain Hall and the water tower. And it is absolutely clear that on both of our campuses we have iconic structures that we all think about as part of what makes the place the place. And you can think of those at the downtown campus as well. When we end up talking about financial resources, it's not because we want to. It's because we actually have a huge gap in our resources against what it is we try and do every year consistent with our mission. So we're about $100 million a year short compared to our peers in Canada and much more than that when we go south of the border. And I think our infrastructure is where we feel it the most on both of our campuses, both in terms of not having enough space and not having the kind of space or the ability to repair and restore those very important symbolic buildings and images. We were giving your dean a lot of suggestions about the water tower at lunch. I don't know whether or not he'll be able to act on them, but in fact it's not a simple financial matter to manage the water tower. It is on the order of annually, you know, $100,000 a year or more to sustain it so that it's not creating a physical risk. So it's always good to be an armchair advisor. So we were thinking about some ideas of how you save the top of it, the iconic part, and do something else with it, put it somewhere else on campus, just restore it because it's the height that poses the risk. With Britain Hall, we need a much different kind of plan, and it is something that for the 8 years that I've been principal has been on the table every year, and we need a rethink of what might be done there, and I know that your dean is engaged in an activity with the support of the provost, to look at are there some things that we might do to really rethink how to fund it, what the function of it would be, so that it might be a provider of some services to the campus, but also to the community, be restored as a great architectural feature of the campus, and also allow for some of the student and academic activities that you want more space for. So I appreciate what you say, and I can imagine having been here, you said 25 years?
Yes. It's unfortunate that the science building of John Abbott's being erected, and it's just out of place, you know, totally out of place.
Yeah.
And it could have been done over at Britain Hall.
Yeah.
And furthermore...
Well, we wish it could have. Actually, at the time, it wasn't possible, and a huge effort went into trying to get it built there and to doing something that would allow us to restore it. But I think we're in a different environment now, and it may be possible to do something.
And also the monument of Sir William MacDonald. If you look at his manuscript, the water tower is on it, and he's facing the water tower.
I hear you.
Thank you.
As I said, we've given some array of recommendations to the dean, and at the end of the day, there's a very strong sentiment to preserve the iconic symbolic part of that in some way. Yes, please.
Hi, my name is Abdel Razak Marhaba. I'm relatively new to McGill, although my children went through the program. I read your recommendation number 7 with interest about facilitating the access to degree programs for outstanding students who have followed non-traditional pathway to education. I think there is room for improvement or to update a little bit the admission process at McGill.
What would you suggest in that regard?
Well, as I said, I'm kind of new to McGill,
yeah,
or coming back to
but
education
that
after
you,
30
that
years.
You a better position to
simply what I'm trying to say is trying to remove any residual bureaucracy in the admission process, any way to avoid having someone admitted by a department but delayed by the downtown office, something like this. I think would make it much more efficient and
Thank you. I know our registrar and our deputy provost work very hard on this, and I think we've made good progress. There's always room for improvement in it. But I think some of the delays to letting people know, please.
Are you speaking more with respect to graduate students? Or
yes, to graduate. Okay. Actually, I hope my case is rather isolated and...
So you have one case you're thinking of?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, comments, ideas? Anything at all? Well, if not, let me just thank you very much. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead.
Hi. Matt Brown, dietetics grad student again. I just want to second Mike's. I just want to basically let you know that students also feel very strongly about this water tower. More as a historical monument of McDonald College. Like Mike said, William McDonald's manuscript there has it written right on there. And I wanted to know about McGill's policy for keeping historic monuments, such as like the Roddick Gates, or potentially including the water tower as a historic monument. Or is there a policy?
Yeah, we work very hard to preserve our infrastructure in general. And there are both institutional and Quebec guidelines for how things get rated and appraised. And of course, we work within the Quebec structure. We have right now over $650 million in deferred maintenance on our two campuses. It's extraordinary. We have the largest continuously running university campus in Canada and one of the oldest continuously running campuses in North America, and have been underfunded for 100 years of that. So both with respect to the way research funding has happened at the federal level, where we don't get the full cost of research, and then in the Quebec context, both on the tuition side and on the grant side. So we've made big strides on that. We've got, so when I say we have $650 million in deferred maintenance, that's with the $500 million in infrastructure renewal and development that's been taking place over just the last 3-4 years and is underway right now. The knowledge infrastructure program of the federal government matched to the province has been extremely good in building up some facilities, our chemistry facility downtown, facilities out at the Douglas Hospital. But we still have just a huge, huge need. And one of the things that we must do is not allow risk to happen. And with old buildings and tall structures that are not financially supported, and none of this is financially supported, there is no operating money that comes designated to our older and historic infrastructure. We're running as fast as we can to keep up with it. So risk is one thing. The starting point is make sure that no one gets hurt by it, and having an unsupported, unused water tower falls unfortunately right into the risk category, and risk trumps icon. But then the question comes, can you preserve the icon in a way that doesn't have the risk of being a tall structure that isn't kept up on a regular basis?
Thanks.
The Secretary General, just technically, the Secretary General is the sort of chief archivist and the arbiter of patrimony and so forth for the university. The Vice Principal, Administration and Finance, our new Vice Principal, Michael DeGrappa, who's coming out here shortly, is in charge of our infrastructure. Professor Jim Nysall, you'll know, is the person who has that as his direct responsibility. But I think the water tower is one that just begs for a creative solution. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not going to be standing alone, unsupported, and maybe banishing it altogether is not the solution either. So what creative things? Maybe you'll have a competition to see what suggestions people can come up with that meets the need of not posing a risk while preserving the symbol and the icon.
I'd certainly like to see students and alumni involved in those discussions.
It would be a great call not just to discuss it, but to help support it.
Exactly.
I think would be terrific. I think of our martlets as iconic, the little birds and the flag of the and the symbol of McGill. And some of you may not know this, but both the University of British Columbia and Victoria University were our western campuses. You think you're the western campus, but actually in the old days, the west coast of Canada had our western campuses, and the University of Victoria still has the martlets in its logo, and I like that a lot because it tells the history, and both of you are saying the same thing. It's part of our history, it's part of our story, and we do want to keep those things alive, and those things are very important to me. Our history is very important. We learn from it. It sets our values. We learn good and bad from it. And it gives us a good kind of pathway as we look to the future. So I know your dean is thinking hard on this.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Sorry, but I have another question.
Sure.
So I'm looking at the list of the subcommittees, and I know that I think previously there was a subcommittee on race and equity. I think.
No.
There was never one?
No, not from the...
Because I thought I had heard that there used to be a subcommittee on race and equity.
I don't believe there was. I'm looking.
Okay.
There's a Senate committee.
Oh, but there was no, like, subcommittee?
Yeah. There's a Senate, a joint board Senate committee.
Okay.
But not there was not a working group of our task force on it.
Oh, so not from the task force, but just I'm recognizing some names from the... subcommittees. I guess I'm thinking
of
the Senate
submission.
Committee.
They made a submission
okay.
to the task force.
But there is a Senate committee on race and equity
correct.
Currently? Okay.
On equity.
Okay. Yeah. And they didn't make a submission?
They did.
They did?
Yeah.
Can someone point me to the page on here?
Yeah. We can help you here
okay.
with that.
Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. I have a cold as well, so I try not to cough.
I'm with you.
I'm both an instructor in Farm Management Technology Program in Humanities here, as well as a newly admitted student to McGill. So I have an interesting dual perspective in that regard. And of course, coming from Concordia, I'm constantly contrasting and comparing different strategies, etc. I had one question. One was expanding the pipeline of talent. Could you elaborate a little bit on what's understood by that?
Well, it is one way of thinking of it is to find ways of going out to potential candidates, both for our student slots and our academic slots, who wouldn't normally think of coming to McGill. They wouldn't think of applying. They might think they might not get accepted, or it simply may not be part of their life experience that they would even think about going to university from the student perspective. So what is to think about what are the initiatives that we ought to undertake to reach out to them so they know about us. If we do something like a transitional year program into university that might improve their odds of getting accepted to McGill, and that I think this goes back to the earlier question on partnering with community groups, to understanding what some of the obstacles might be. So if we think about our Aboriginal students from the north, one of the things that we've learned is, well, and you just have to go up there to see the difference in lifestyle, the enormous adjustment that's required. You know, you think of McDonald as a quiet, more pastoral environment than the downtown of Montreal, but the difference between St. Anne and Iqaluit or one of those islands, I mean, you just can't describe it without being there. So the kinds of supports, put aside the cultural differences, so a culture of very, very strong community, very, very strong family ties where you don't do anything without your family and community being there, and then think of flying south and coming to be a student here. The challenges are much different than they are for someone from this community, from Montreal, from Vancouver, from India who wants to come. So we want to think about that carefully and, in fact, have some initiatives underway to do that. But want to do that in a way that commits us to really thinking about what happens then. You know, so just doing it is not enough, but to actually think, are we having an impact? Are our partners viewing us as successful in the way we're partnering with them? And then do we actually change the diversity of our student and academic staff bodies by doing that?
Mm-hmm. Thanks for clarifying on that, because I wasn't sure what was meant by pipeline as opposed to increasing the diversity and reaching out outreach in general.
And I think that is, you know, there's we talked about, you know, political correctness and language is really important. The way we talk about things is important. But I think talking about pipeline is a way of moving away from affirmative action and quotas, which has been, was a methodology south of the border, to saying there are other ways of diversifying. And you know, let's take gender as an example. You know, there have been a lot of studies that show the way you recruit women into positions, that's not just not students, but into professorial positions or academic administrative positions, is different than the way you recruit men. That women often, and there are always exceptions, but women often won't put themselves forward, expect someone to reach out to them. Men often are more comfortable putting themselves forward. Now, that doesn't take into account culture and other things, but just if you just look at who will come in. And I met with someone early this morning in a community partnership context who was saying how great that you have a woman professor at McGill. You know, make of that what you will. But then we were talking about how, in fact, there were more women deans, women departmental chairs, and women university presidents of the research universities in the 90s than there are today. Well, why is that? You know, is it that we thought that, you know, that was a success and people didn't focus on it? So that, these are just examples, and they all have their limitations as examples, but to show that you need to, if you really want to not keep replicating yourself, you have to think about reaching out more broadly.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the idea of qualifying years is, of course, widespread in other comparable universities.
Yeah.
Getting back to other things that were mentioned, like using technology in the classroom, mm-hmm. I've recently signed up for a PhD seminar with University of Sherbrooke that will be offered on the Longueuil campus through video seminars, so it is interactive. And, of course, U of Laval has webinars which aren't interactive but still use video as courses themselves. So that's an interesting alternative, but other schools and programs and teachers have made attendance a requirement and added video feeds as a supplement to the course, so that could be one strategy. I've also taken the same workshop that you were talking about as a student, and at Concordia it's a 5-day teaching strategy, pedagogical technique training that is incredible, and traditionally teachers only take it in their first year, if at all, so it's not as widely used as it could be. I'm really grateful for the work that was done both by the task force and, of course, by everybody who was present. I can appreciate the interests, particularly involving community involvement, I should say, as part of curriculum and coursework. I know, for instance, Concordia has just started the first session being this upcoming fall, two courses that include a community service component rooted in problem solving. So the first course is to address a real community need and design an intervention plan, and then the second course is, of course, implementing that intervention plan. So just to see it institutionalized and valued in that sense is very interesting. So thanks.
And these are great suggestions and great examples, like the SAGEP one as well. What is one of the challenges for us here is how many of these innovative things go on, mm-hmm. and unless you're directly involved, you simply don't know about them.
Yeah.
And so we can learn a lot from each other within the McGill community as well as from our sister institutions, and both are important.
Yeah, absolutely. I know farm management technology, for instance, is considering integrating leadership components beyond their current offerings, so it's interesting to see how that's become a more recent priority.
This issue of whether or not technology is an assist or the main event in teaching is a really important one. And I was saying at lunchtime that for myself personally, I'm really undergoing a bit of a transition in my thinking, because I think if you look at the 20th century, it's absolutely clear that for the research-intensive universities, it's an assist, not the main event. I believe that's still true, but what that means, how it's expressed, is really changing. And if you look at how international our character is, how many of you, both as students and as academic staff, and some of our administrative and support staff are involved in international activities, it can mean some very intensive technology-enabled experience, some very intensive, you know, contact sport, elbow-to-elbow work, and that it's probably likely, as we undertake really looking at having progressive, innovative pedagogy, that we'll have a range of activities. And again, the challenge will be for us to share them, learn from each other in doing them, and generalize them where it makes sense to do that. But thank you for your comments.
You know, I, now that I think of it, I have one last comment just to echo what someone else raised in terms of the customer service for registration, application, advising, getting schedules. It's trying to reach someone at McGill is like trying to reach someone at Bell. So it's very difficult and discouraging in that sense. So that is not a facilitating factor.
Yeah, and that's interesting because we've worked very hard on the downtown campus to have unified services, and it's interesting for us to think about then how we extend that model to McDonald's. And I don't know enough about the thinking that's gone into that, but it's certainly something we ought to do because we've had just rave reviews on the service point approach downtown. Yeah, and you're speaking at the doctoral program level? Content, okay. Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. Good. Okay, well, with that, I will, first of all, let me say again how much I appreciate the work of the task force members, some of whom are represented here. You want to? I've got the time. Yep. Time for one last.
Hi, I'm Peter Percy, FMT year three.
Just go a little closer.
I'm Farm Management and Technology year three.
Yeah.
Over the last 2 years, we, as you know, lost the cafeteria, and now there's less student space on campus. What are your thoughts about making the student life better on this campus over the next 5 years?
Well, let me say it's a high priority to do it, to make life better for students on campus. Most importantly, it's a high priority for your dean and for your academic colleagues. How that will happen is going to be developed in the context of the campus's master planning and the weighing of priorities for space here. One of the things we were talking about, and it's not just a student issue, it's a staff issue as well, food services and frankly services year-round, given that you're part of a smallish community that doesn't have a lot of local services. So there are a number of things that I know are being reflected on, and I don't want to prejudge those by pronouncing on them, but it is, of course, a high priority.
Because I was also wondering, since we've been paying into an athletics complex for the last few years and we haven't heard anything really of it happening, so could you elaborate on that?
I don't know about that. Do you want to? Why don't we have our dean come up and say a few words?
Just to respond to that, the Deputy Provost and I have been working very actively on that file. And there is a committee that has been established, chaired by the Associate Dean, Professor Lewis. I see Drew Love is here as well.
Our Director of Athletics.
Drew is on that committee.
Drew, why don't you stand up just to be recognized for a moment?
I think the concept that we are working on is going to address several of the points that you have raised and others with respect to having a facility on campus that would deal with a new facility that would deal with the growth in enrollment that we've been experiencing, some of the problems we have with classrooms, but also would bring student life and learning together in one area. And the goal would be to have athletics, student advising, the student affairs office, the internship office, the student health facilities, counseling, all together in one building to service those needs that you raise, cafeteria, food services. It's very much a work in progress. The goal is to have a draft plan by April, I think, Morton. And then we would review it internally. Of course, there are many steps for that to eventually be realized, as you can imagine, but it is under very active consideration as we speak at this time.
And when did the initiative begin?
We started last summer, I guess, was when the late last summer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, good. Thank you. Good for you to be impatient. You're going to be a student here for a time-limited period, we assume, and these are ways that you can contribute. But we really do depend on you thinking about the ways that we support these initiatives, too, because if we had the resources to do it all up front, we would. We simply don't. So thank you for that. I want to thank the dean and colleagues for welcoming us to McDonald campus today. I want to thank the task force members who are represented, and through you to all of those who work really hard on this. I urge you to give us your feedback in any way you think would be helpful. And thank you very much for coming out and participating today in the town hall. Look forward to seeing you next time.